Today's podcast is brought to you by Every Wednesday, a plan to inspire the people of Portland and support the place we call home. Let's get out of the house and spend some time with each other. Skip Zoom, meet for coffee, take your colleagues out to happy hour. Buying a gift? Ditch the internet and support a local maker by shopping in-store. Head into town every Wednesday and see what's going on at everywednesdaypdx.com.
Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
In 2019, a man named Salvador Martinez Romero stabbed four people during a meth-fueled crime spree on the West Side. After his arrest, he was deemed psychologically unfit to stand trial and sent to Oregon's one locked psychiatric hospital, which kept Martinez Romero for 3 years. Prosecutors then argued Martinez Romero was ready to face trial, even though doctors admittedly couldn't resolve his delusions. A judge agreed with the prosecutor and sent Martinez Romero back to jail to await a trial set for next year. His 3 year stay at the overcrowded hospital did not restore him to competency, and Lucas Manfield reports it cost about $1.5 million. It's Saturday, March 4th, and this is episode 113 of The Dive. Today I'm talking to Lucas Manfield, whose cover story, Revolving Door, shines a light on a huge contributor to Oregon's mental health crisis: the lack of sustainable or effective care for the three groups of patients served by the state's single locked psychiatric facility. Those found guilty except for insanity, civilly committed patients that presented danger to themselves or others or simply can't take care of their basic needs, and mentally ill patients charged with a crime but unable to assist in their own defense, like Martinez Romero. Over the past decade, patients like Martinez Romero have outstripped all patients in the other two categories. Lucas is going to break down why that is in just one sec, but first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. Portland Fire and Rescue has four two-person vehicles that answer lower acuity calls, freeing larger vehicles up for larger emergencies. But the Bureau's budget was just cut by $2.7 million, and those four vehicles may soon be eliminated. Anthony Effinger reports that as City Hall plans its budget, some bureaus are squeaking by. See, Fire and Rescue's hiring freeze slash emergency vehicle loss, and also Parks and Rec's light pole removals. But Portland's Clean Energy Fund has one of the biggest and most loosely restricted budgets in the state. Unfortunately, they also have no way to say, whoa, we have way more money than anticipated. Let's use it on other stuff, like, say, four rescue vehicles and some replacement light poles. Top five hot plates this week are from Wine Bars, Street Disco, and Heavenly Creatures, Jade District Noodle Shops, Master Kong and Fortune Barbecue Noodle House, and if you're doing coastal things, Pelican Brewing in Silets Bay. Am I saying that right? Silets? Now let's catch up with Lucas Manfield about his cover story, Revolving Door. What exactly is happening to the criminally psychotic Oregonians between county jails and the psychiatric state hospital?
They're going back and forth. And so basically the key problem is that if someone is arrested for allegedly committing a crime, and they are believed to be too mentally ill to essentially defend themselves in court, you can't prosecute them. And so the question becomes, what do you do with them? And you also can't keep them in jail because, you know, innocent until proven guilty. You can't just keep someone in jail.
Yeah.
And so they have to be sent to essentially be what's called restored to competency. And it's some version of mental health treatment that should, in theory, get them in a mental state where they're capable of defending themselves. The way this system, and this system works differently in every state, essentially. The way it works in Oregon is they're shipped off to this hospital. and it's in Salem. It's actually two facilities, but the main facility is, you know, essentially down by Salem. And it's a 700-bed hospital. They're shipped off down there. They're given treatment. And then, in theory, at some point in time, they're going to be, you know, capable of defending themselves. And they're shipped back to whatever jail they came from, and they go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, I mean, there's many problems with this system. The first problem is that the hospital is full.
Yeah.
And so people end up waiting in jail to get a bed. And that has resulted in many lawsuits, or essentially one major lawsuit that has been going on for 20 years. And so, you know, as more and more people are coming into the system, you're backing up. The other problem is that with people going back and forth is that, you know, people get the way we essentially treat mental illness now for severe mental illness is medication.
Mm-hmm.
And the medication sometimes works well, but when it does, people often don't want to keep taking it.
Yeah.
And so we medicate people up when they're in the hospital, they're sent back to the county, and sometimes they don't keep taking their medication.
Yeah.
So even if we're able to prosecute them, if they end up back out on the street, they're often back in the same problems they were in the first place until they get arrested again. And so that's kind of the concept of the revolving doors, that people are going back and forth between the hospital, the streets, the jail, and we haven't figured out a way to stop it.
Yeah. That hospital out in Salem serves three main categories. And I'm wondering who is worse affected by the whole revolving door scenario. Is it the people that are convicted because they can't stand trial and they keep bouncing back and forth? Is it folks that are convicted of, you know, guilty by reason of insanity? Or is it the civilly committed patients? Like, who's getting the shortest end of the stick?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I'll just say that, like, you know, no one's coming out well from this. But the so basically one of the solutions that has been happening again for years and years and years is that because the hospital isn't big enough to accept all the patients, because they've been sued by patients that are waiting in jails, they've essentially prioritized people that are waiting in jails.
Mm-hmm.
And so the result of this is that almost everyone that is being admitted into the hospital at this point has either been convicted of a crime or charged with a crime.
Whoa.
And so the result is that, I mean, that has a lot of consequences, which, you know, are somewhat debated, but certainly it makes the hospital a higher acute, so essentially a more dangerous place.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to be deeper in their psychoses. People aren't as far along in their treatment. And so it becomes more dangerous for staff, becomes more dangerous for patients, and you get more problems.
Yeah. Who decides when, if ever, a patient is capable of standing trial?
Yeah, that's the question. And that is really the question that came up. This story, you know, that we're talking about, is kind of about many things. It ended up being mainly about what we just talked about. But
mm-hmm.
the reason that I actually focused on this case from the beginning was from what you just asked, because it is really a perfect example of just how complex a question that is. Like, and you don't want to think too hard about it, because
oh,
like, it really goes off the rails.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to ask, like, I mean, it's this question of what makes someone sane.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the answer to that question is incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what happened in this guy, in Salvador's case, is that, you know, he was clearly extremely mentally ill. I mean, he tried to commit suicide in jail. He was, you know, there's evidence that, you know, he might have been on methamphetamine at the time, but he was certainly in some sort of psychosis at the time. But by the time he was at the hospital, it was kind of unclear whether there was an underlying, like what underlying mental illness there was and, you know, how well it was being treated.
Yeah.
And so there was just, you know, this debate going back and forth on whether he was in essence faking his symptoms. And essentially what happened in the end is some clinicians had suspicions that he was faking it. Other clinicians were not convinced. There was a very interesting argument, which I didn't go into at all in the story, about, you know, because he was essentially self-reporting delusions. So he would say he experienced delusions.
Mm-hmm.
And prosecutors actually pointed out, like, I mean, he is believed to be from Mexico. And his delusions revolved around essentially demons and witches controlling the outcome of the trial, which, again, very much worried clinicians, because you don't want to have to make someone decide whether they're going to plead guilty on a murder thinking that the trial was being controlled by supernatural beings. Like, that is not a fair justice system, and we want to avoid that.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, is prosecutors are saying this could be a cultural phenomenon. Like, maybe it, from a cultural standpoint, he believed, like, that was just a normal thing to believe, that the witches and demons were involved in life. And we don't want to say that someone's, you know, insane because they believe things that are, you know, just culturally normal for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of these things came into effect. There was 2 days, 10 hours of argument over this, and a judge ended up saying there was enough evidence that he was malingering, but the judge thought he was ready to stand trial. And so that's why he is now back in jail.
Ugh.
Yeah, huh. Really tough decision. No one wants to have to make these decisions. This was a very particularly contentious one, very contentious. And a judge has to make this.
A judge makes it. So is it fair to say that non-medical professionals are making decisions about someone's mental health?
Yeah, and this is, I mean, it sounds, that sounds really bad. But on the flip side is that it's really a symptom of this fact that the criminal justice system is intersecting with the mental health system, right? Like,
sure.
We do, if you think about it from a criminal justice perspective, we have to have a judge making these decisions. Because mm-hmm. The judge in the criminal justice system is the ultimate arbiter about what's going to happen. And so it makes sense from that standpoint, but it is really just one of those situations where we have a mental health system that wants to treat people, and we have a criminal justice system that, you know, in theory is trying to point us toward justice, and they are very much not aligned. And
yeah.
Particularly in this case, they were not aligned.
Yeah. Why is there only one psychiatric hospital?
That really comes down to basically this is a long-standing phenomenon. It's a national phenomenon. Basically, we, as a country, we decided we wanted to start closing asylums for good reason. Mm. It was really, they were very bad conditions in there. It was not a good idea. You know, the long history of abuse, a long history of, you know, euthanasia, I mean, just horrible stuff, lobotomies, that sort of thing. So one of the solutions has kind of been over time to try to shut down these like central institutions and reimagine kind of mental health care as something that we're providing in the community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a term called deinstitutionalization. You know, this has been going back to the 50s. And it's been a national problem that we just never really figured out how to make that transition. So we closed down a lot of these big institutions, but didn't figure out a way to pay or fund or staff a lot the community stuff that was supposed to replace it. And Oregon in particular is certainly very much struggling with this. The main evidence of that is that we just have one of the highest rates of mental illness in the country, and our system hasn't really adapted to that.
Did it ever come up why Oregon has the highest rate of mental illness in the nation?
I mean, people talk about this. I mean, it's a very, very hard question to answer. And frankly, I just haven't, you know, I haven't heard, you know, an excellent answer that I can quickly soundbite here. I will say that there's a longstanding belief that, like, we kind of fail to prioritize mental health care in the state. Oregon, you know, we don't have a ton. We're not like California or something that just has, like, tons of money to kind of throw around at problems, right? So Oregon, we have a limited budget. And this is a very expensive problem to solve. And it's also a problem that, like, you can't just kind of solve it and then walk away, which is, like, basically kind of what happened is that we spent a lot of money. We spent $500 million building this brand new hospital back in 2012. And then there's kind of this belief that we basically stopped kind of prioritizing the issue, thought we'd solved it. And, as we've seen in the last 10 years, I mean, it's just, this is, mental health has become a much, much bigger issue. And, we haven't continued prioritizing it.
If we've known about these issues for this long, why aren't we doing anything? What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good way to think about it is that the system was, I mean, we got sued 20 years ago because people were sitting in jail.
Yeah.
You know, disability rights advocates like sued the state. And the state kind of came to a compromise and said, hey, we're going to limit this to 7 days. And for majority of the time since then, I mean, it's been hit or miss sometimes, you know, they've managed to keep that until the pandemic. And so I think one way of looking at this is that the system was really, you know, it was kind of held together by, you know, duct tape.
Yeah.
Right. And like people were trying to make it work. We were creating like, so essentially like we were solving the problem, people waiting in jail by essentially not letting civilly committed people into the hospital. And we were kind of ignoring the consequences of that. And the consequences being that there wasn't really a place to get people help unless they committed a crime. And I think the pandemic just, you know, totally snapped this system that was held together with duct tape.
Yeah.
And the results are now we're scrambling to figure out, like, what, I mean, you got to scramble. Like, what do? You duct tape it back together?
Yeah.
Or do you rebuild the entire thing and kind of like know that we're going to have this huge problem for the intervening years? And so that's the problem facing the legislature right now is like, do they spend money on the existing system trying to pull it together, or do they spend money trying to reimagine how we do this whole thing from the beginning?
Yeah. So if we're reimagining how we do this whole thing differently, what are we reimagining? Like, what are some of the community solutions that were talked about in this story?
It really depends a little bit on who you talk to, but there are certainly some states have gone away entirely from the centralized institutional model.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont is kind of thrown around as an example, which is a smaller state, probably not really comparable, but you know, they kind of went that direction. Other things that I've heard, like LA, for example, as I've heard, is like an example of a city that does a much better job of kind of like at like the front end, like when we arrest people for things that look like they're, you know, mental illness related, kind of shuffling people out of their criminal justice system. Because if you're able to do that at the front end, you avoid these larger issues that we ran into, mm-hmm. right? Where now, like, in order to get mental health care, you have to go through the criminal justice system. But one strategy is to simply just, you know, shuffle people out and get them health care otherwise. And then, you know, there's other kind of related to that, like Arizona is doing what they kind of call like this, you know, a centralized like crisis center. But like, basically it's kind of like a centralized place that police can bring people where they can essentially, you know, have a more positive treatment environment to get over whatever mental crisis they're in, then being sent to jail, which is obviously going to make things worse.
That's just going to exacerbate everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we really lack that right now. So those are like some various solutions. But yeah, I mean, I will say that, like, you know, there's debate about, like, there's no, like, one gold standard. Everyone's like, that's the route you need to go. I mean, there is some debate about which direction you want to take.
Hmm. No blueprint. Hmm. Is there any silver lining to this story?
No, there's no silver. I mean, this is truly, like, I like writing about these issues because I find them outrageous. Like, I really think that this is just horrible. I don't have a silver lining. Like, I really think that we are absolutely letting everyone down. I think we're letting down the people that are suffering from mental illness, and we're letting down the public. I mean, look at Portland. Like, so many of our problems in Portland right now are because people with untreated illness are living out on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone has different reactions to that, and everyone has different, like, ways they want to solve that problem, and everyone gets very political about those solutions. But the reality is that these are people that need healthcare and they are struggling. And I think that gets lost. And so, you know, I have sympathies for everyone that wants to propose different solutions to this. And I see where everyone's coming from, but I don't see an immediately obvious solution that's being presented. And so, you know, that is extremely, extremely frustrating. And, you know, that's why I like writing about it, is that I just think that, like, we can't remind people enough about what's happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully, you know, spur people to, like, keep thinking and come up with that solution in the end when someone's smarter than me can figure it out.
Big thanks to this week's guest, Lucas Manfield, and thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Until then, bye.
you.